The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Andrea, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Hi, everybody. My name is Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here tonight, and I'm glad to be sober. I want to thank my friend Karen for extending the privilege of me participating in Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It's my opinion, and I hope it always remains such, that it's some type of a privilege to be allowed to come and sit in these rooms. I have never been able to get it through my sick head that I have a right to everything that goes on in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just because I got sober and stayed that way. The reason I say that is because everything that's good and decent in my life today is the byproduct of the God I discovered sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't even know why I'm alcoholic, if you want to know the truth. I think it has something to do with the whiskey I drank. I figured that out all by myself. It seems like to me, and I'm not really sure because I really don't know that far back as I can remember. It seems like as far back as I can remember, I was looking for some type of an answer for whatever it was. And it proved to me that I was looking for an answer that I knew there was something wrong with me, and I didn't know what it was. I had this restlessness and this irritability and this discontentment in my soul, and I didn't understand what that was. And I knew that I had to find some answer to this thing, or I wasn't going to last very long in this world because it was a very tormenting thing. And it was nothing new in my family because my family all drank whiskey. They were bootleggers and whores and gamblers. And so it was we didn't have much going for us, but I came along and really made it dysfunctional, for Christ's sake. Those people never seemed to bother me. What they did and what they didn't do didn't bother me. When they would gather up and beat each other up and steal each other's women and go away to jails and all that stuff, it never seemed to bother me. What always bothered me is after they'd come through with one of their things that they did, they would put their arms around one another and say, "We love one another because we're family." Something about that bothered me because I don't remember uttering that word to another human being prior to coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time after I was here. It just wasn't in my vocabulary. I started looking for a way out of this dilemma a long time before I ever got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got here, I was looking for a way out because I didn't think there was any way out. I've come to understand that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous somewhere around the 4th of November, 1959, when I wandered into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've come to understand, basically from my own particular case, that I was in an absolutely perfect state of being for a guy to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was absolutely and totally hopeless. I was living in some type of a hell that I had created through my actions. And I was going to live there until I either died of an overdose or I was going to get shot or killed in one of them gang fights. And that was my only MO. I didn't have any other thing going for me when I stumbled into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't even take any credit for coming here. Because if I'd have known where I was coming that day when I came, I wouldn't have come. So I don't know how in the world a guy like me could ever possibly try to take any credit for any goodness that's happened to him since he comes to Alcoholics Anonymous if he can't take any credit for coming here. I never even dreamed about Alcoholics Anonymous. I never dreamed I was going to drink. I didn't want to be like them people. But I did take a drink. One day I sat on the back porch of my grandfather's house and took a drink of alcohol out of my grandfather's fruit jar. And my whole life changed. I didn't realize it was a drastic change, but there was a pattern for living that was triggered then that I followed right up to the day I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. What happened to me is I took a drink, and 3 days later I was underneath a bridge and stood in front of a judge and sent to a reform school. 20 years later, I took a drink of alcohol and I was pulled out of a car in Compton and stood in front of a judge and sentenced to 20 years in the penitentiary. And in between there was the whole thing. And what I learned in juvenile hall in the early 1940s when I was in juvenile hall, I was introduced to the wonderful world of gangs. I found a place that I could fit in and I could masquerade my fear with my violence and my hostility. And nobody seemed to care, and the harder I tried to be a member of that gang, the more I was accepted, and the more I was accepted, the harder I tried to be a member of that gang. And it was just the most amazing thing that I know of. They were all Chicano gangs. I ran around with Mexicans all my life. I didn't even know I was white till I was 6 years sober, for Christ's sake. But I went to reform schools, I went to junior penitentiaries, I went to penitentiaries, I went to nut houses. I just traveled all around out there in the world. I could never get it together. I never one time ever thought about ever getting sober. I never one time ever thought about quit doing the things we were doing. I never quit one time ever thought about changing my life and doing better. I just thought that was the way I would live. That was the way I was in director of this life. That's the way I was going to live until somebody blew my brains out or I got killed in one of them gang fights. And I knew it was never going to be any different. And I accepted that. I accepted that and everything that went on with it. But way down deep inside of me, when I was alone and I wasn't out front and I wasn't playing my game, I didn't have my little images up, I always said to myself, I don't want to ever do this, but I'm powerless not to do it. I don't want to live this way. I don't know what to do. And I've had an awful lot of opportunities in my life. I was given an athlete body. I was given an arm that could throw a baseball through a wall. I was given an eye that could hit a BB, and I could give a pair of legs that could run like a deer. And I was offered all kinds of opportunities. When I was in a boys' home in the San Fernando Valley, a place called Pacific Lodge Boys' Home, I was offered a scholarship to go to the University of California, Los Angeles. And I had just to play baseball. And the funny thing about that is I love to play baseball. I love to play baseball more than I love to eat. I still love baseball. It's still my favorite thing to watch. And I'm just a little bit too old in the tooth to play it anymore. But I still love it. I've always loved baseball. And I probably always will till the day I die. And I never got there because I came out of that reform school, that boys' home out there. And I stepped right back into my game, and I started picking up the things that I did and started doing the things that I did. And I really did think when I was offered that opportunity, I was sitting with a guy today who would tell me about his grandson. We had all this opportunity to play baseball. He's a senior in high school. He's got all these credentials. And we were talking about it, and I said, the intoxication of being offered the opportunity to play major league or professional baseball is intoxication to a guy like me who loved baseball. I remember when the guy offered me the opportunity to play baseball for the St. Louis Cardinals. I was in state penitentiary in San Quentin in 1951. And I felt like jumping over the fence that night just to go play baseball because I wanted so badly to do it. It's like a dream come true, and I could never do it because I came out and jumped back into that way of life that I had, and I didn't know any way of doing it. And I didn't know what was going on. And that's the way I lived my life. When I was 13, 14 years old, I was introduced to the wonderful world of drugs, and it became a part of my life for the next 20-some years of my life, but it just went along. In those days, it never got outside of the ghettos and the barrios that I lived in. It never got out into the Brentwoods and the Westwoods and the Hollywoods and all those kind of places. It just stayed down there. I'm not saying that it's any better or any worse now than it was then, but that's where we lived. We lived down here. We did those kind of things. And we committed the atrocities, and we committed the acts, and did the things of violence that people like me do who live in the world. And all the time, I never wanted to do it. And all the time, I did it anyhow, because I was scared to death that somebody was going to find out I was scared to death. I was afraid my fear was going to be exposed and I was going to be chastised and threw out of the gangs and I had no place else to go and no other choices. It's a terrible way to have to live. It's a terrible way to have to do that. And the thing that masqueraded and made it all well was the things I injected into my system, into my body. It kind of took away the pain. It kind of made it bearable for me to live with the atrocities I committed it wasn't so bad. I can't stand here and blame alcohol or industrial or any of the things that I did. Alcohol was the best friend I ever had. Alcohol kept me alive long enough to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only thing that ever worked for me that kept me alive long enough to get here. I know as well as I'm standing here. If I hadn't taken a drink of alcohol, I'd never live to be 12 years old. I know that. I know without a shadow of a doubt, if I can look back on it and see where I was headed and what I was doing. And I didn't have any choice that matter. And I ended up in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had just spent the last 5 or 6 months of my life in and out of solitary confinement of a maximum security penitentiary. And the reason I was there is because I stood in front of a Superior Court judge in Los Angeles. And I was standing there, and everybody was sitting in the courtroom, and a man called me a blood-sucking parasite in society. He told a woman who was sitting in the courtroom, who was pregnant with my oldest daughter, that if she cared anything at all about that child that she carried inside of her, that I'd never be allowed to lay eyes on it. Now, I don't know what happens to you when you come face-to-face with the first truth of your being, and you're here in an open courtroom, an open room, what you really are that you've always known that you are, but I'll tell you what happened to me, because I didn't have anything to masquerade it anymore. My brain exploded. And for the next 9 months, I was in and out of solitary confinement. And that way, I came stumbling into this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't come here to get sober. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because the institution I was in let women come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it'll soon be 49 years ago, to smell perfume. I've been honking and sniffing around her ever since. It doesn't make any difference if you knew why you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't make any difference at all. I mean, I don't think anybody came to Alcoholics Anonymous with good motivation. I think we come here for a lot of reasons. I came here because I just wanted to look and see what was going on. I'm looking for another group of people to hate, if you want to know the truth. I'd run out of them. And if you're like me and you live like me, sooner or later you'll run out of them. Sooner or later there won't be anybody left to hate. There won't be anybody left to point the finger at. There won't be nobody left to chew. And you're not liking you too much anyhow. And there I sit that day in that row. I moved in and sit in the back row where people like me move in and sit. I wasn't a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't alcoholic. If you'd have called me an alcoholic when I walked in the door, I'd have probably hit you with something. I don't know what an alcoholic is. I'm always amazed at the people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous without any knowledge of this illness of ours, who are so self-diagnosed that they know they're alcoholic a long time before they get here. Not me. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I'd never been called one. I'd never been pointed towards Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never been pointed. I've been called a lot of things, but Alcoholic Anonymous or alcoholic wasn't one of them. And I moved in and sit down in the back row where people like me sit. I didn't want to move up front. Somebody might mistake me for a member of AA, whatever it is. I looked up on the back where I saw these two big gates, and I thought to myself, I wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade. What is this? I said to myself, or this guy sat next to me, and he said it was Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat him down in my seat. I didn't want anybody to see the big gangster hanging out with them winos. Then Gangsters Anonymous, or Over Hip Anonymous, or Dope Fiends Anonymous. Dope Fiends. Kind of wild and dope fiends. This attic seemed a little candy ass, don't it? I've always figured if you're going to be bad, you ought to be bad. Really. I don't think you ought to quit drinking because you puke a little either. I think you ought to hang in there. I think you ought to give it everything you got. I think Alcoholics Anonymous work a hell of a lot better when you run out of options. I threw everything into the battle that I could think of, and I lost the battle. And I didn't even know when I was fighting. I didn't have a clue what was wrong with me. Because I walked out of institution from the time I was 10 years old until I was 30 years old as physically sober as I am this moment. And not one time did I ever say to myself, self, do you realize how long it's been since you've had a series of electroshock treatments? Why don't you have a drink? No. I never one time ever thought about have a drink of alcohol and go out there and kill your baby brother. Have a drink of alcohol and go out there and tear your mother's heart out one more time. I never one time ever thought about that. I just took a drink. And then the drink took a drink. And then the drink took me. And that's the story of my life. And there I sit at this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that day, not knowing, as I've come to understand, that I'm staring at an answer that I have sold my soul for. See, I can't recognize the answer because I don't know what my problem is. It's hard to seek the answer to a problem if you don't know what it is. And I didn't have a clue what was wrong with me. And I sat in these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and these people got up to talk about this thing. And they were funny people. I mean, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there weren't really young people hanging around in AA. These old people got up to talk. One of them said she drank for a long time, this woman. I looked at her and said, yeah, you can look at her and know she'd been somewhere for a long time. She said, I used to drink. I said, I bet you did. Bad stuff, too. See, I knew everything when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a walking encyclopedia of useless information. I know so much about what ain't true, I don't know what is true. There I sit, for all intents and purposes, a dead man. And I don't know any other way to do it. And I'm staring at this answer, and these people fascinated me. They fascinated. I couldn't understand what it was. I understand today it's the message that one alcoholic carries to another alcoholic, even though the alcoholic doesn't even know he's an alcoholic. Alcoholics know about alcoholics. Alcoholics have this message of one alcoholic talking to another, and no matter how dense or how far back or how blinded or how egotistical driven the alcoholic may be or how far removed they are from reality, an alcoholic will have his heart penetrated by the message of another alcoholic. It's the most amazing thing that I know of. And there was nobody's heart any harder than mine when I got here. There was nobody so far removed from anything than I was when I got here. There was no person so far away from thinking there was an alcoholic or belonging here than there was when I was here. But these people fascinated me. They fascinated me by what they did. They got up on Sundays. They drove 100 miles up those old back roads, bought their own gasoline. There was no money in the treatment of alcoholism in those days. The American Medical Association had diagnosed it and made a disease yet. There they came. I couldn't figure that out. They're really strange people. I just, and I sit in the back row and make fun of them. I'll tell you how very sick that is. Here I am sitting in the penitentiary. I don't know when I'm going home, and I'm making fun of people who are leaving in an hour. Oh, but I'm alcoholic. I'm hip, you know. I'm so hip the balls of my feet tickle me when I walk. I just kind of bounce around me. You ever see the little jitterbug bounce around in the street corner and the little dolls? Well, I invented most of that. But I don't know what this thing is. And I kept coming back to your meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous because they kept saying there was a different group coming all the time. And I said in meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous, if you knew, maybe this is happening to you. I don't know. But what was proven to me when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous was that I was an alcoholic. And I was proven to it by these type of words. People would get up at podiums very much like this, and they'd say things like, I used to drink, now I don't drink anymore, and everything is just wonderful. Now, back there on inventory point where I'm sitting, I'm saying to myself, I guess I'm not alcoholic then. I'm not drinking either, and I'm crazy. About how I wish I was alcoholic, I used to say. If I could just be alcoholic, then all I'd have to do is not drink, and I would be okay. But there's something far more wrong with me than that, because I'm not drinking. And what I'm trying to do, and unbeknownst to me, because I don't know, because I had never investigated the book Alcoholics Anonymous, so I knew nothing about the illness alcoholism. Unbeknownst to me, I'm trying to equate a drinking problem with an illness called alcoholism, this debilitating sickness of the soul. The book talks of the malady. It does not recognize our illness. Our book doesn't. The only authority in Alcoholics Anonymous does not recognize our illness as a disease because it never mentions it as one in our book. Our co-founder who wrote our book never described our illness as a disease. He called it a malady, an illness of a spiritual nature. And I didn't understand that for a long, long time, but I understand it today more than anything that I know of. It is a spiritual illness, and it needs a spiritual solution. It doesn't need a running around chasing your tail kind of a solution. It needs a spiritual solution to arrest his spiritual malady. I didn't know that. I just sit in these meetings and look at these people and say, I wish I was alcoholic. An amazing thing happened to me one day. I'm sitting in this meeting of alcoholics. And if you're new, and you go to a lot of meetings, I'm sure sooner or later somebody's going to come in if you're alcoholic. I don't know whether you are or not. Somebody's going to come around here and ring your bell for you. I remember sitting in this room this day, and I watched this man walk into this institution that I knew had did 23 bad years in the penitentiary. He was my baseball coach when I was a star second baseman for the San Quentin Pirates. And he could have appointed an Alcoholics Anonymous and told me something that all the great psychiatrists and sociologists and criminologists in the state of California and the federal government who looked at me never seemed to know. He looked down where I was sitting and said to me very simply, you don't have to live like this no more if you don't want to. You don't have to do it like this no more. Nobody had ever said that to me. They've been telling me since I was that high that I shouldn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things. But they never told me how to live without doing it. They just said, don't do it. And what none of these people ever took into consideration is very simply this, that every time they told me that, I was as physically sober as I am this moment. How many times I wanted to scream out at them across the table, even in the confines of my straitjacket, and saying to them, good God, doctor, don't you understand? Because they don't. I'm sorry. If you're not alcoholic, you'll never understand why I drink. But if you're not alcoholic, I'll never understand why you don't. I mean, it's really kind of pathetic what they say. I mean, my older brother, who was not alcoholic in any wild stretch of his imagination, tried to get him drunk a couple times. He took a couple of drinks and said, I'm quitting. And I asked him why, so I'm starting to feel it. I thought that was kind of weird. And then one night, the last time I ever went out with him and ever made that stupid attempt to try to get somebody drunk who's not alcoholic, we were out drinking. He said, I got to go home. I just got paid. I said, what? He said, what are you going to do? I'm going to Mexico. He said, you don't even have a car. And I said, I'm still going to Mexico. See, I don't understand that. I really don't understand it. Of course, he didn't understand, well, I was going to Mexico either. I walked up to this man after the meeting, this little guy by the name of Les Hamlin. He's dead now. And I asked him a simple question. I didn't even know what I was asking him or why I was asking him that. I just said to him, how do you learn how to live? I wasn't interested in staying sober from that day to this day. I wasn't interested in having this good life that I live today. I wasn't interested in any of that, living peaceful and comfortable in my own skin most of the time. I wasn't interested in finding a God of my very own. I wasn't interested in having people that I love and people that I wasn't interested in that at all. What I really wanted, I didn't even know it at the time. I just wanted to be able to lay down and sleep all night long without the use of some type of chemical in my system. I wanted to keep from waking up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning with those nightmares of standing outside of the gravesite handcuffed between two detectives while they bury my baby brother, while my mother looking across that gravesite at me with all the hate in her eyes that anybody could ever. You see, I'm one of these people and I'm not proud of it. I tore my mother's soul out of her skin. I destroyed my mother's soul with my action. And the final crushing blow to my mother, what I did to her is I killed her baby. And my mother, until the day she died, hated me. No matter what I did to make it up, no matter how many amends I tried to make to my mother, no matter that I took care of her the last year that she lived, like a diligent, loving son, my mother hated me till the day she lived. And she was well-intentioned and she was well-right. I didn't deserve to have her forgiveness. I didn't deserve anything. Kindness that my mother offered me. I didn't deserve any of that stuff. And I know it as well as I'm standing here. But I did whatever it was that I could do to take care of my mother because I loved her even though she hated me. You taught me that. Nobody else did. No school taught me that. No amount of education taught me that. The kindness that you showed me and the people who became my mother in Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the mother's love that I needed. A man told me about a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous that's almost being mistakenly forgotten in AA. He told me there was a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in the library. And if I'd go get that book, he'd go home and pray that I'd find some part of me in it. I went over the next day to the prison library and stole the book Alcoholics Anonymous out of the prison library. Well, you got to remember one thing. I got a big-time gangster image. I don't want my name signed out in the prison library along something as lame as Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a big image to hang on to. It damn near killed me, but I was going to hang on to it. And I opened up the book to read it. And I didn't read the book Alcoholics Anonymous or study the book Alcoholics Anonymous or fulfill the conditions that the book demands that I fulfill to maintain any degree of sobriety or to come about with some type of a spiritual awakening. Not at all. I had the Losers theme song in my head as I opened up the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to read your book, but I'm going to do what it says to do, and I'm going to prove to you my case of difference that it won't work for me. The Losers theme song. You don't seem to understand my case is different. Good. Things started to happen to me. I started to do what has to happen to an alcoholic of my type, I suppose. If I'm going to obtain any degree of sobriety or comfort in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to have to start identifying with what's written in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. But what happened to me one day, I'm sitting here reading a doctor's opinion, and it talked about a phrase in there called the phenomenon of craving. And it caught my attention, and I started to think about it, and I started to think about all the opportunities that I had in my life. The opportunity to go to school, the opportunity to play Major League Baseball, all the things and all the talent that I was given, and all the stuff that was given to me and how it never seemed to happen. And my excuse had always been that it wasn't my fault, you see. I came from them drunken people. I lived in them ghettos and run with them gangs. I committed those atrocities. I've been in every institution that the state of California has to offer from a kid from the time he's 9 years old till he's 30. It's never my fault, you see. I'm a victim before there's victimization. I am a victim. That moment, I believe, way down deep in my soul, because I've had a long time, I've had over 48 years to look back on it. I believe at that very moment of my life, I took the first step in recovery. Whatever it may be. Because right then and there, I realized that the reason none of those things ever happened to me was I took a drink. And right then and there, with that admission way down deep inside of me, I started to assume the responsibilities for my own actions, no matter what it was. It was no longer anybody else's fault. It was nobody's fault. It wasn't the drug's fault. It wasn't the alcohol's fault. It wasn't the gang's fault. It wasn't the barrios I lived in. It wasn't anybody else's fault. It was my fault. I assumed the responsibilities for my own actions right up to that moment and right up to today. And I sat in a room with a man, and I did what our program of recovery says in the fifth step. And somewhere in there, I heard myself say to that man that I was an alcoholic. From way down deep inside of me, it came. And I didn't understand what happened to me that day, but that day is when I took the first step of the program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says it in the second paragraph, chapter 3 of our book. I have to concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. I have to wave my hand and say that I am. I've got to concede to my innermost self. That means I've got to give up the battle. And I'll tell you, I've given it up. I know what's wrong with me. From that moment to this moment, I have known exactly what's wrong with me, and I know exactly where my answers are, and I know exactly what the solution is. From that moment, you see, what I know today is what I never knew before I got to you. I know exactly what's wrong with me. I'm an alcoholic, and I suffer from this illness called alcoholism. I'm not an alcoholic and anything. But I was an alcoholic and something or other. I just couldn't have our program. And the reason I couldn't have it is I separated me from you. I'm not quite like you. I'm a little different. I'm a little better. I'm a little worse. I'm a little smart. I'm a little blah, 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 blah. And so when I walked out of the penitentiary on June the 4th, 1961, I had a dream. I never told anybody about it because I think it was so far-fetched. I didn't think I was ever going to be worthy enough to have it happen. I had a dream that maybe someday you would let me come and sit in your meetings with you. I never dreamed that you would ever ask me to do anything around here. I didn't think I was worthy enough to do anything around here. I thought there was a little place that you put people like me outside of you good people where I could get the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I wasn't allowed to associate with you good people because I didn't know anybody like me. Or I could get the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I wasn't allowed to associate with you good people because I didn't know anybody like me who got sober. And I did, but I said to myself, the thing they asked me to do. I'm very pleased to be able to say tonight that for almost 47 years of my life, I've done whatever it is Alcoholics Anonymous has asked me to do. I don't always do it willingly. I'm just a little leery of people who can't hardly wait to get to their next meeting. I just say to them, get a life for Christ's sake. I went to a meeting one night and a guy walked up to me and told me he's going to be my sponsor. Now that's kind of hard when you know everything there is to know about Alcoholics Anonymous, the way it's written in a book. I had a lot of knowledge about this thing. And I had been given this gift of peace inside because of the inventory and the attempt to make the amends the book says I do. But I knew nothing about the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never knew how to live around people. I knew how to live around guys in an institution. I knew how to be a part of a gang. I knew how to part of, I did a lot of things. I didn't know how to be around normal, decent people. I didn't know how to be around mixed crowds, around people, women, and all that kind of stuff. And so this guy walked up to me and started to teach me how to do it. And the way he said he was going to do it was, he said he was going to be my sponsor. His name was Norm Alpie, and he's probably the greatest member of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever known before, since, or ever will know. He said to me, I'm going to be your sponsor. And I said, well, what is that? And he said, I'm going to help you get things done that need to be done. I said, okay, what do you want me to do? He said, why do you ask me? I said, for Christ's sake, you just told me you're going to be my sponsor. He said, if I can't run my life, Johnny, what makes you think I can run yours? I said, what am I supposed to do, Norm? He said, why don't you just do what I do? I said to him, what is it you do, anyhow? And he gave me this deep, deep answer. He said, well, if you do what I do, then you'll know what I do. For you who are new, I have just broke up the great mystery of sponsorship. It's called Monkey See, Monkey Do. The only problem is you've got to pick the right monkey. There's a lot of people running around here in monkey suits that ain't monkeys. They tell you all kinds of stuff. Oh, you don't have to do that. Oh, I used to do that, but I don't do it anymore. You don't have to do that anymore. No, no, I used to. No more. Stay away from them. They'll kill you if you're alcoholic. Now, if you're not alcoholic, none of this stuff will make any sense to you whatsoever now. But if you're alcoholic, like I'm alcoholic, your life is on the line every day. I didn't know that. I didn't know I was afflicted with a deadly illness. I didn't know that. That was going to kill me or drive me insane. I've already been insane. I was already pronounced dead on arrival once. I've already been there. I didn't know all this stuff. First thing this man told me was to go to work. Get a job. He said, you're a bum. I told him, I'm not a bum. He said, what are you? I said, I'm an AA member. He said, no, then you're an AA bum. Bums don't work. I got a job working in the oil field, which is not a thing for a big-time high-roller dope dealer like me. Somebody stole my first paycheck. I don't think that's funny. I tell you, nobody screams as loud as a thief when they get stolen from. I ranted and raved and hollered and jumped, and when I got all through, my wife said to me, now you know how it feels. I didn't think that was funny either. I went back to work that afternoon, and I've been working ever since. I stand here before you tonight, all my bills are paid. Got a little money in the bank. Got a nice little house that I live in. Got a lovely, lovely woman that I adore, that I share my life with. It's a far, far cry from that lonely kid standing there who just wanted to come to me. You see, I didn't even think when Norm told me he was going to be my sponsor, I didn't think I was worthy enough to ask anybody to share their time with me. I didn't think I deserved to have anybody even share any type of time at all, let alone tell me anything. It wasn't that I didn't want to know, it's just that I didn't think I was capable or worthy enough of having any of it. I still don't. I still don't think I'm worthy enough to impose my nonsense on my sponsor most of the time. I really don't think I still sometimes don't think that I'm worthy enough to be allowed to do simple things like make coffee or set up meetings or sweep floors. This little meaningless task in Alcoholics Anonymous is seemingly so far below everybody. To me, they're amazing things. Amazing things. What this life has launched me onto, what this man has taught me. And the other man who came into my life, who became the only father I've ever known. What a magnificent old man he was. He's the most spiritual individual I've ever known in my life. And I watched him, and he's the most active man I've ever known in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. To watch him all the time. He'd tell me crazy things. Crazy. I'd ride around the car with him. He'd talk to me in riddles. Easy does it, sweetheart. I've done things like, I remember one night we were coming back from Santa Maria. I was thinking about this the other day, and I was up north, and I coming back from Santa Maria with him one night. It was a late night. We were riding in his car, and I'd stolen it. I quit talking to him altogether, because every time I said something to him, it was wrong. You know how you want to parrot everything these wise people know. It's always wrong. And I was telling him, so I just quit talking at all. But I was up here one night, I was sitting around on the literature table, and I picked up this piece of literature. And it was really kind of, for an egotist like me, who was feeling a little less than, it's really kind of a wonderful thing. It says, why we were chosen. Oh, that's really good for your ego. You know, I'm special, I've been chosen. And so I tried to read this to Papa. I said, let me read you this, Papa. And he said, okay, what is it? I said, why we were chosen. He says, throw it out the window. He said, what makes you think we're chosen? And I said, that's it right here. He said, that's crazy. What makes you think we're chosen? I said, because we're sober. I'm sober. I know a lot of people who are better off than I am who are not sober. How come I'm sober? He said, well, you've come to understand something, Johnny. You've come to understand you're one of God's kids and you act like it. I said to him, well, how God's kids act, Papa? He said, oh, they just wander around the world and they try to help people get things done that need to be done. They do it for free. They do it for fun. What a great concept of living. I like to tell you that I live like that all the time. And there's no profit motivation in my life, or there's no ego-driven situations in my life where I want to do this or want to do that. But basically, I ride around in my car every day with a couple of goats. One of them's name is Chuck Chamberlain, and the other name is Norm Alpy, in my car with me all the time. I think about them every day, and I miss them every day very much. But what they left me was a great legacy. If I don't continue to try to live the way my sponsor taught me to live when I was new, and I don't continue to try to live the way my papa tried to teach his son Johnny to live when he was new, then I might as well go out and pee on their grave. If I don't continue to try to go on and pass on the same way it would pass on to me, the things that would pass on to me, then I have no right to even be putting those people into my conversations. None whatsoever. I can only tell you this, that every living thing I have in my life, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous, the way I feel inside, the God that I believe in, the woman that I love, the friends that I have, the things that I do, I owe to this program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And you better believe this. It is a long, long walk from a cell in solitary confinement to the maximum security penitentiary where I stand right now. But for the grace of God, AA and good people like you, I could have missed it all. Thank you.